and welcome to episode 15 of Sounding Board. Today we're providing a new take on the Talking Heads shows of a few years back, with Spangles and Space Hoppers, Lisa Rogers and Denise Van Outen replaced by Brass Eye, The Da Vinci Code, Gordon Brown and Gareth from The Office. The Noughties, or Noughts, or Zero Zeros, whatever you wish to call them, depending on what side of the Atlantic you're on, are far too recent to run the rule over, but that's not going to stop us. So welcome to today's guests, and we've got Neil Kennedy back, showing a late career resurgence after a period of inactivity and being described as late of this parish on last week's podcast. Hello, Neil.
Hi there. Yeah. It's like my demise is overrated.
Yes. Right, as Mark Twain said. And we have a new guest, Tom Sutton, who's a keen follower of all musical and cultural trends in the decade we're going to plough into, and deviser of classic Oxford Club night, Needle in a Haystack.
Oh yeah, oh, I didn't realise you were going to bring that up.
any chances of a revival for that particular evening?
Well, one of our former members is now in Stockholm, and the two of them are having babies, so I'm not sure whether they're going to have another one anytime soon, but... Right. Never say never.
And so welcome, Tom, anyway. Good to have you on.
Good to be on.
So first of all, fellas, before we go into the noughties, music news, anything that's caught your eye?
Yeah, I listened to All Song Considered as a really good podcast from NPR in the US, and they were doing their kind of roundup, or their follow-up show after South by Southwest, which I think was... last week, maybe coming up for 2 weeks from now, and they were talking about the sort of best acts that they saw while they were there. It's quite interesting to get their perspective, because I think for some of those guys it's their first encounter with some UK bands who maybe have had like an album out over here, but they haven't really had much distribution in the US. So they were talking up in quite a big way Anna Meredith, who we obviously were big on last year on this show, and also they were seemed to be really taken with Let's Eat Grandma, who are the two-piece sort of weird synth poppy, slightly Kate Bushy outfit. I think possibly seeing them live in a kind of South by Southwest scenario meant that they were... that kind of lends themselves a wee bit better to representing what they do. The other band I was interested that they spoke about was a puppet emo band who were apparently on at the festival, called Fragile Rock, who sound like it's sort of shades of Avenue Q, but actually being sort of like via the Muppets, via, I don't know, Fall Out Boy or something, or Weezer or something like that.
Is it Frank Oz on vocals?
Yes. It's pretty, sounded pretty amusing, if not necessarily something you'd want to listen to across an entire album.
Right.
And they released the Austin 100 yet? Usually NPR have like 100 tracks that you can download for free.
They didn't mention that on the show, but
it's something that Stephen Thompson does on the Pop Culture podcast, but
it's definitely worth checking out as a show. It's interesting to hear their kind of their views, and it's obviously interesting to see how it's been coloured by the places that they saw certain bands in as well, which is unlike, I think, any other environment that you can watch music in South by Southwest, by all accounts. Yeah,
it sounds good, and I certainly recommend the All Songs Considered podcast. Very enjoyable most of the time. Tom, I think you might have some news from deepest Oxfordshire.
Well, I just saw a Truck had sold out already, but that's all I've got to say about
that. Truck Festival, which has got a good bill, we think, this year. Yeah, that's our local festival for the recording studio where we happen to be based. I think Franz Ferdinand, the Libertines and the Vaccines are heading the 3 days, and there's lots of sort of really interesting sort of newer stuff like the Moon Landings, like lower down the bill, so probably a bit pointless speaking about it given you won't be able to get in now. Anyway, my bit of news is a little bit old, but it was recently revealed that Paul Weller has launched a £400,000 crowdfunded share offer to expand his mod-inspired clothing brand, Real Stars Are Rare, which just I thought was culturally very interesting as someone who I think, certainly when he was in the Jam, was like very much at the vanguard of, socialist belief and extreme kind of, very,
Red
very
wedge
kind of left-wing,
well.
Radical, Red Wedge, etc. And not that crowdfunding is necessarily sort of, you know, and the antithesis of that, but I think it just shows how things have shifted in terms of standpoints now. So that kind of entrepreneurial activity, you know, which before might have been seen as opposite to sort of being left wing, is now less so.
Well, Bradley Wiggins needs a wardrobe, I guess.
He does, doesn't he? Yeah. So, and I think there are certainly some sort of similarities to the sort of pretty green label, which I think is Liam Gallagher's particular brand of threads. But yes, Weller anyway, interesting character he remains. After this break, we're going to be looking at the decade that was on before this one. Hi again. We're going to talk today about the noughties, as we mentioned at the start of the podcast. The noughties, the noughts, zero zeros, whatever you want to call them. And to kick off this very potentially wide-ranging discussion, I should say we're going to be focusing very much on what you might call the alternative noughties. So there ain't going to be a lot of Justin Bieber or Beyonce. Justin Bieber's probably actually the current decade. That shows how much I know. Yeah. And we will return to hip-hop, R&B, lots of other musical trends from the noughties in future podcasts. This is very much going to be the kind of alternative independent universe, for want of a better term. The kickoff, we're going to sort of, each of us are going to talk about a band or an artist that we particularly liked during that decade. And Neil, you're going to start.
Yeah, I was going to start off and talk about Interpol, who I think kind of came out in this decade, appeared fully formed really with the first album, Turn on the Bright Lights, which was in 2002. It was a record that really spoke to me. It kind of got pegged with a lot of post-punk influences, which you can obviously see with certain other bands were something of a hallmark of the decade. There was certainly a revival of those. But I think they sort of had a darkness to their sound which went beyond just kind of sounding like an old XTC record or something. And that first record, I think, I say they kind of landed fully formed. It wasn't just, there was a consistency across the sound of that particular record, you know, tied to really, really strong songs as well, and the also a consistency to the way that they looked, you know, with the, you know, the kind of sharp suited look that they had, that really made them stand out from a lot of what had gone on in kind of indie rock music in the previous sort of 5 or 10 years. Sadly, I think looking at them across the noughties as a decade, there's a bit of kind of diminishing returns that went on with their records. Antics, the record they brought out afterwards, which I think was only a couple of years afterwards, was had some really good singles on it, but I think it didn't really move the game on much from the first album. And Our Love to Admire, which was the other one they brought out in the noughties, they've brought out two in the decade following the noughties, whatever we're calling that. That had, again, had some good songs, but again, I think didn't really progress things a huge amount. And I think they've kind of started to move into an area where they've got now kind of hardcore fans, but you know, have a lot less kind of mainstream appeal that they had. So I think they're kind of make an interesting case study, really, of, you know, a band that came out of New York as well, which was an important place too for music in this particular period. They make a kind of interesting case study for the noughties.
I think there were other bands in that decade who have like diminishing returns, who started in the 2000s.
Very
the Shins, I think, are another example of
a
band.
Yes.
Iron and Wine even as well. Yeah. I think the diminishing returns happened in this decade actually.
Possibly true about a lot of bands in history. Yeah.
That's true. Yeah, definitely. And I think it's possibly something that you could see the start of the noughties, the noughties as a decade as a whole have sort of haven't been the kind of last clarion call of you know, major label rock music or whatever before the industry kind of, you know, I suppose it depends whether you want to say it shifted or it, you know, transformed, or just basically disintegrated, you know, where labels are able to throw a lot of money at kind of indie rock bands. So that's probably like a deeper discussion, but, you know, Interpol are an interesting kind of example of having a lot of kind of profile, you know, as a first band with a first album, which is much more difficult to do now, where I think you get someone like Car Seat Headrest, who's actually released a ton of albums before he ever gets onto like an indie label, you know, like and has success. Yeah,
indeed, and a real staple of the indie discos with some of their classic tunes, I have to say. And
yeah, absolutely,
I really, really enjoyed some of their stuff early on. So good one to pick. Tom, you have slightly different artists who maybe started a bit before the noughties.
Yeah. Right? I mean, the person I've picked, I mean, yeah, started in the 90s, didn't start in the noughties at all. And I don't think he represents the noughties in any way, but he had seven albums in the noughties, originally as Smog, and then as Bill Callahan as a solo artist in his own right. And they're all crackers. I mean, one was a Rarities album, so that's but you know, still, I think that's a pretty consistent hit rate. And I suppose I became a fan of Smog and then Bill Callahan in the noughties, you know. So I guess that's why I picked him. It was Rain on Lens, I think, was the first Smog album that I kind of really got behind and got into. And I think when I first listened to it, I didn't immediately love it, and but then I listened to it again. There was something about his unique voice. There was something about the kind of economy of the songs that kind of I was interested in. The more I listened to it, the more I liked it. And I found that with all of Bill Callahan's records, that they're all growers. And that first listening experience may not be the most immediate. And they're actually albums that you you know, grow to love. Not like an acquired taste, like a weird cheese or something, but something that's got, you know, like real depth. And you know, he's a person. I've seen him live a couple of times as well. He can actually command quite a large room. I saw him at the churches in Islington in London. I can't remember the name of it. Union Chapel, yeah, exactly. Yeah. And you know, had a room completely spellbound, and it was just him and a guitar, and I think that's an achievement for anyone. So
yeah, as someone who's just dabbled with, which would you say was the essential album?
My favourite is his final of the decade. So Sometimes I Wish We Were an Equal. I think I might have said that wrong, actually.
That's
but
right.
That's the album that I go back to. Tracks like Too Many Birds, Jim Kane. It's a fantastic album, and I even had Bill Callahan music played at my wedding. We had Bill Callahan reading at the wedding.
Should have gone along.
fantastic. Well, as for me, I mean, I first became aware of the slightly clunkily named LCD sound system. And you've got to remember, this was an era when it was de rigueur to call oneself the something. So the Hives, the Vines, the Strokes, etc. On the release of their debut album, which actually, my memory played some tricks with me, was a bit later than I thought it was. It was January 2005, so kind of midway through the decade. And it was heralded by a quite ludicrous review from the ever wonderfully pretentious Paul Morley, who welcomed the record in Observer Music Monthly with a 3-column list of all its influences. I remember like Sly and the Family Stone and particularly standing out, and it was just a list of bands and artists. The LP was helpfully accompanied by an additional CD of original singles, including the era-defining track Losing My Edge, which I think had come out in 2002. I've actually just had a piece about a week ago posted on the Toppermost website, which is my 10 favourite LCD sound system tracks. If you have missed them, I mean, I'd say the influences is a mix of punk, funk, indie, The Fall, Talking Heads, Can, The Rapture, and a lot of fun. Looking back, I feel that the high point was a sort of 3-song salvo in the middle of their second album, Sound of Silver. With North American Scum, which I think is one of the kind of signature tracks of the decade. Someone Great and All My Friends, which is just a wonderful track about like heading to someone's house after drinking of an evening. I just think they're one of the noughties great bands. And when I say bands, really the whole shebang was the musical project of one man, James Murphy. Incredible kind of creative force, and like a sort of, you know, impresario in terms of, you know, Death From Above Records as well. So I have to say, given that they're rumoured to be bringing out an album later this year for the first time for almost a decade, it is with some wariness that I contemplate that. As always, you worry that heroes will block their copybook, but I think, tremendous looking back on them.
I was there at the very first LCD sound system.
I was going to ask Rob what you thought about the fact that they split up, and then they had a reunion, it seems, within about 5 minutes, you know, whether that was kind of a cynical kind of ploy on the part of James Murphy, so in those to play the game, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, this is interesting, that, isn't it? I mean, that's a whole great pub conversation about, like, when is a decent amount of time for it to be regarded as a band reforming, you know?
When you
like,
get divorced.
I think Oasis probably split up, like, through individual fights between the two brothers probably about 50 times.
That's very true.
Did they reform 50 times? And then there's the whole kind of more comebacks than Frank Sinatra line. Tommy Doherty used to pedal. So yeah, they're a great band. Yeah. There's a new band actually I've just discovered, a British band who are the first one I've heard to be really, really explicitly influenced by OCD Sound System, Formation. Their album's out this week. Quite interesting. But possibly in places just a little bit too slavish a tribute, you know, so
I'm
really
sure I saw that Hookworms from Leeds, who you wouldn't necessarily have pegged as LCD Sound System fans from their musical output, I'm sure I saw that they did maybe it was a charity show or something where they actually just played LCD Sound System songs. They just were like a tribute act to LCD Sound System for one night only, which must have been, short of seeing the real thing, which you obviously can do now because the bridge formed, is a pretty good alternative, I think.
Ooh, I'd love to have been at
that.
So anyway, just generally talking about the noughties, obviously one of the major things that changed over the course of the decade, arguably maybe just before, were things like Napster, you know, so was sort of more online presence, and particularly in terms of the press. So the traditional music press certainly seemed to lessen in impact. The Enemy was in at the start of its like long, slow decline, which continues to this day, not only in sales but in terms of kind of relevance. And they were replaced by online tastemakers such as Pitchfork. What do you think have been the main implications of that trend and related trends, folks?
I think with sites like Pitchfork, and there are lots of other sites like the ones you mentioned, they kind of promoted a diversity of listening, I think, in a way that kind of print mags, which kind of took on a canonical or viewed themselves as kind of Bibles of what was cool, would very much kind of give bands certain profiles, but they had to fit within quite strict parameters, I always felt, you know. I mean, the Enemy, although they've had sort of forays into the world of grime and dance and stuff like that, it's always very much the kind of, like, you know, indie, you know, sort of music scene Bible or whatever, whereas it seemed like Pitchfork, although I remember in the noughties when they started, they were really kind of pushing indie rock stuff, post-hardcore stuff, a lot of folk Americana stuff, less so kind of hip-hop and dance, although there was awareness of that. I think they've moved a lot more in the kind of hip-hop direction, whether that's a reaction to the prevailing culture, whether, you know, we've had discussions on this show about, you know, where guitar music is at these days, you know, is it kind of a sort of dinosaur, you know, that's dying, you know, and being replaced by R&B hip-hop as being the kind of true sound of, you know, kind of youthful rebellion or whatever, and they're reflecting that, or whether it was more an editorial decision to say, we're employing people who care more about that stuff than care about, you know, the latest Shins album or something like that, you know.
I think it's an interesting question, that, because, I mean, it was also like a real battle for the soul, around about the time of Acid House, without wishing to go too much off topic, the real battle for the soul at the NME and Melody Maker, in that I think some of the journalists wanted to introduce Acid House and dance music and hip-hop as part of the paper's agenda, and of course that is absolutely necessary. You have to reflect, if you're purporting to reflect music as a whole, you have to kind of reflect these things. But then, of course, you have your audience,
of course,
don't you? And at the same time, you have to kind of bear them in mind, and you don't want to alienate them. So I think it's quite easy to be caught between rock and a hard place.
Yeah. I think Noughties was the time when the audience changed to the extent that they didn't need the gatekeepers in quite the same way.
Sure. Good point.
Yeah. You go to the internet and find things for yourself. Mm. And I think that musical publications, whether in print or online, had to react to that. And it was easier for the online publications to do that because they didn't need to be, you know, X amount of pages. You know, yeah. they could have as many features as they wanted. I think certainly, you know, personally speaking, I stopped listening to specific radio shows in the noughties because I was able just to kind of go on my own, you know, online, into my own little online rabbit holes, you know, and find the music I wanted to listen to. And I guess one of the things that came with that, with the pitchforks and also websites like Tiny Mixtapes, is they became more and more obscure because it was easy for people to find the most popular things. So they had to kind of, you know, push to the edges, and sometimes they'd be able to focus on really unusual, interesting acts, and sometimes stuff that was just so obscure or maybe a bit too obscure for the sake of it.
But now we have the Quietus, which can have 100 best albums of the year and you've literally only heard of three of them. And one of those is Beyoncé or Solange, to throw in you know, this impression they've listened to literally everything.
But the cult of the DJ has been replaced by the cult of the blogger now.
Absolutely.
The blogger has to be, you know,
you can see that, I suppose, obscure. In a positive way, that, you know, that sort of technology has democratised music criticism. That, you know, in a way that, you know, in the, even in the 90s, you know, someone could disagree. The only way they could disagree with a sort of NME journalist was to write an angry letter into the letters page. Whereas now they can, someone who's really passionate about music can go and set up a blog and write about the shows they're going to, the records they've heard, highlight things, particularly in maybe in geographic regions or areas that don't get as much coverage as traditionally got covered by the print press, you know. So
in the 90s I had a letter of the month in Select magazine.
Did you?
A letter flagging off Gay Dad, which
is really
good to talk about.
I'm glad you qualified it was Gay Dad.
I hope you weren't slagging them off for the name, because it was a good name.
And their artwork was very good as well, I thought.
The whole kind of road sign stuff. Gay Dad, my goodness,
horrendous music, I think.
Yes. No, they were very much a kind of passing fancy, weren't they? Obviously related to this is the whole issue of streaming, and I'd urge you to go back and listen to one of our previous episodes, which I think was episode 7 or 8 last year, which was on streaming, Spotify, all the pros and cons. You should be able to find it on our Podbean website, and that's where you can download the pod, by the way. It's soundingboard.podbean.com, as well as on iTunes, etc. So the early part of the decade, if we think back to this, because of course the noughties was quite a long kind of period, there was a very much a sort of spirit, particularly in the UK, but I think to an element in the US as well, of what you might call revivalism for the post-punk era. And that did produce, like, you know, quite a broad wave of very interesting music. Any thoughts back on those times?
Yeah, I mean, it was, for me, remembering the decade, it's kind of synonymous with that kind of, like, wiry, jerky post-punk sort of, you know, guitar sounds that were coming from, I mean, I mentioned Interpol, that was maybe a bit more stately, but bands like Franz Ferdinand, the Futureheads, Bloc Party, I could go on, and they were obviously taking influence from, yeah, a lot of those kind of very late 70s, early 80s bands like Gang of Four, XTC, The Fall, you know, and also those, you know, those bands that kind of married up funk and disco with guitar music, more like ESG and things like that. I suppose the 90s with Britpop, certain bands, certainly the big bands, were taking a lot more cues from the 60s music, you know. So Oasis were pretty unashamed in how much they ripped off the Beatles, because in their view they were allowed to, because they were the best band ever, you know. So you know, just makes sense to rip them off, you know. And Blur are obviously taking a lot of cues from the Kinks and stuff like that.
Also, why?
That's true. But then I think I'd say that I don't think there was much appetite to see bands, if they were going to recycle past, you know, genres or periods of music, to see a kind of straight punk photocopy for the mainstream, you know.
Yes.
And so post-punk, because it was that bit more obscure, and possibly because it was a bit more kind of palatable, than, you know, trying to do a sort of pastiche of the Sex Pistols would have been, meant that that was the next kind of musical trend that people moved on to when they were taking influence.
Yeah, rarely did a review get published in that era without the word angular.
Yeah,
appearing.
Absolutely.
Tom, any thoughts on that era?
Asymmetric haircuts. I was just thinking of a friend of mine having a haircut in Hoxton at the time, and the hairdresser asking him if he wanted a snippy snippy, and that meant Nathan Patrick.
Yeah, so Nathan Barley, of course.
Yeah, it was around
course,
that time.
It was that time, which really hasn't abated, I have to say, spending a fair amount of time in Hoxton as
and,
I do.
Yeah, I found it, I was at university in the early noughties, I found it a particularly exciting time because you could go out and, because of the post-punk influences, you were listening to things that were kind of indie dance crossover, I guess, which is, and that was... It opened my mind to a whole lot of music that I hadn't known before. I mean, I thought I had a pretty good overview of punk because I'd had the best punk album in the world ever, parts one and two. But some of these more, sort of that came after punk these bands taking their influence was new to me. I thought it was great time.
Yeah, and you touched on sort of dance music there, Tom, because on the face of it in the late 90s was the absolute kind of heyday, certainly commercially, of dance music, the waving in the air, like sort of Love Groove Dance Party Ibiza type Dave from Bedford ringing up and saying, "We're banging," and all that kind of thing. And that kind of sort of, a lot of these faceless kind of DJs were popular for like a blink in time. And then what happened at the start of the noughties?
I guess you had things like Too Many DJs as well.
Yes, taking
their influence from a wider range. I mean, Lady Trauma did a fantastic remix of Natural's Not In It by Gang of Four.
These sorts
of things were coming out, and you were hearing a new sound that was taking, reappropriating an old sound. And obviously, that had happened with Beatles cover bands in the 90s. But this was stuff you could dance to a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, I remember going to Errol Alkan's kind of club night trash at the end. Hardly got in. In fact, on my right up on top of most of my LCD sound system. Review. I do recount that evening, which my friends did find very amusing. My attempts to try and get into a club, but once in, the influences. It was very much in bed with that Too Many DJs culture. There were all sorts of signature tunes. You had like Dolly Parton mixed in with New Order, with Justin Timberlake, who's a big star. We're not really going to cover today, but we probably will do on a future pod about the more mainstream noughties. All very, very interesting stuff. And I think there was the crossover was as healthy as it ever had been at that point, and then later on in the decade we had people like Fuck Buttons who really, really sort of moved the template forward again. So quite exciting. I mean, lots and lots of stuff. Of course, the other sort of musical trend of the decades was Americana, which underwent a massive revival in the noughties, and the Czech Shirts are still with us. In fact, they've kind of sort of fed into the whole hipster thing.
Yeah.
Guys, what were the main reasons for the upsurge in acts from that particular genre, would you say?
I mean, I think there was as much going on in the 90s as there was in the noughties. I guess in the noughties it just hit the mainstream in a big way.
Yeah.
I mean, you'd had albums from Palace Music, Bonnie Prince Billy in the 90s, Smog, as we've talked about before, but then you had a popular upsurge. I guess Ryan Adams was maybe one of the reasons for that, because he, after Whiskey Town, hit it really big with his first two solo records. I guess that's what happened there.
The thing that I kind of remember was the kind of freak folk movement kind of breaking out into the mainstream, as opposed to have just been a niche concern of people like Joanna Newsom and Devendra Banhart, and they, you know, that became a lot more, and doing weird stuff with, you know, Americana folk music, stuff that would have been considered more fringe, I guess, actually being, you know, featuring on Jules Holland and stuff like that. You
well,
know.
The phrase alt country,
yeah,
really
exactly,
came from that
yeah,
point, didn't
yeah,
it?
Definitely.
So I suppose
yeah.
Granddaddy, I was debating with David Cox, who was on this podcast in the last episode
yep.
this morning, about when Granddaddy's software slump came
that
out.
That was 2000.
2000,
yeah.
So yes, yeah.
yeah.
So it kind of set the tone for the decade. And then towards the end of the decade, probably Fleet Foxes soundtracking the highlights to the FA Cup final probably sort of showed the absolute where it reached its apogee in terms of not necessarily quality, but in terms of sort of, you know, profile. So yeah, it's a really, really big thing.
Yeah.
Much of what we talked about up to now has been US based. If arguably the previous decade, Britpop had obviously been prominent. We're going to talk about Britpop on the next podcast. In particular, sort of areas that were already unaffordable by the start of the decade, including sort of parts of Brooklyn, such as Carroll Gardens, Park Slope and Williamsburg. I mean, Brooklyn became this kind of incredible kind of artistic hub. So many of the bands, if they weren't actually from Brooklyn, they certainly kind of went there and based themselves there.
Yeah.
There were great venues, such as the Knitting Factory and North Six. You know, I think it would be hard to argue against Brooklyn's sort of, you know, centrality to the decade in terms of alternative music. Any thoughts on that and the way that it also then seems to have begat the whole hipster culture? I mean, is it?
Well, I think one of the things that you could say about noughties music is that it was it drew from so many different influences. You know, it pulled in different directions. If you think of bands who became big in the 90s, in the noughties, like Arcade Fire and Broken Social Scene and Animal Collective, you know, they were infusing quite a lot of different. And so it's really, I guess it's no coincidence that a place like Brooklyn, you know, in a city like New York, which is again, you know, a melting pot of, you know, so many different cultures, would become kind of central to that moment.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, you mentioned a couple of bands that are Canadian, of course, but I think Montreal equally, I think, was obviously like had a good decade. But yeah, I think certainly, I mean, bands like The National were from Ohio, but you know, when I lived in Brooklyn, Sufjan Stevens, you know, people like this.
And Dirty Projectors.
Dirty Projectors, who we're going to talk about later on, and it's timely that they have an album out, you know, in view of the topic of discussion today. So certainly when you go there still, I find it exciting. I mean, it's you know, a creative hub. You know, there's a lot going on, not just in music as well. You
absolutely.
Know. Certainly in coffee, there's a lot going on. Yeah, apart from that, yeah.
In craft, to be good.
So, exactly, yeah. So really good. So did the political scene of the time influence music at all, fellas?
Yes, I guess. You know, I mean, there was lots of reactions to Bush, I guess, musically. Don't know whether any of it was very particularly good. lots of punk acts. Like
NoFX they had a big, big kind of, you know, they were part of a, you know, big backlash against the war in Iraq and you know, I mean, that whether or not that comes through in kind of the extent to which any of that came through in mainstream music culture,
Green Day
possibly.
Green
yeah,
Day,
sure.
I guess,
yeah, no, you're right. Yeah, yeah.
They were reacting to the time.
It's hard to say. I mean, it's hard when you're still so close to a decade, isn't it, to really trace that political lineage, you know, that you know, this event, the gap, this record or something, is quite hard to say. And I wouldn't say that many of the bands were sort of noticeably political either. I think this probably starts, noughties probably around about the kind of decade where people start to actually ask if political music is even a thing anymore. You know, I mean, obviously that's people who aren't sort of looking at the underground, you know, punk scene where there's always, you know, people shouting about inequality and, you know, and consumers.
None of us know that much about hip-hop, I guess. I mean,
we did hip-hop on the last episode and did raise this. We actually argued strongly that, particularly now in the current decade, that it is the musical form where
comment is. And I think, you know, issues like racial profiling and stop and search and things like that, you know, really were, you know,
concerns in the noughties, I think, you know, certainly in the mainstream kind of media, and were reflected in some of the grime music, I think, from like very tangential awareness of what the kind of lyrical content was there. So that, I mean, that's probably a better bellwether, I'd say, of, you know, kind of political, you know, unrest and things. Yeah,
I mean, arguably in Britain, I mean, it was a decade when, you know, he's not looked back with too much fondness now, but, you know, Tony Blair was in power for like almost that entire decade, and the Labour Party was in power for that entire decade, which meant that certainly compared to now, there seemed to be a slightly more content country. It was, of course, there was the big anti-Iraq demonstration, Countryside Alliance, all that kind of stuff, but you know, it seemed to be a calmer time looking back on it in Britain anyway, you know, despite obviously some horrific events. So
I'm trying to think of people who I saw at the Left Field stage when it, like, Glastonbury that decade, but all I can think about is just Billy Bragg.
He's not really a noughties figure.
He's probably still at the Left Field stage now.
And what about in how music intersected, this is a big question, but with film and other cultural events?
There's some great soundtracks. The Wes Anderson soundtrack was fantastic that decade. I was bought the Wes Anderson soundtracks, and I didn't usually buy soundtracks. So.
I think it's probably only a bit tangential, really. I think they do separate in slightly separate ecospheres.
I mean, I suppose, like, one, talking about film soundtracks, the soundtrack to the film Lost in Translation that came out, and was again a good sort of, had that sort of continuing line between the shoegaze kind of stuff and then drawing in new kind of music which kind of reflected on that, but obviously in a very specific context of, you know, that kind of Tokyo setting.
I mean, I think Phoenix have got a track on that, like one of the bands who, you know, like, you know, in the middle of the decade, you know, had quite an impact towards the end of the decade, probably. Okay, all right, well, that's some interesting discussions there. Obviously, we've completely failed to nail it because it's, you know, it's too recent, and it's going to be very interesting, I think, as time moves on, to try and see how people look back on it. Yeah. Personally, I find a lot of hindsight does help, and it will be interesting to see how that decade kind of shaped music going into the current one.
I think you can begin to see that, certainly looking at the album we're going to be talking about later on. You know, R&B hip hop did, in terms of production, did become fantastic in the noughties, and we're beginning to see, you know, bands that are kind of fusing that now.
Yes, absolutely. More of which after this break. Hello again. So we've just talked about the noughties for 35 minutes or so, and now we're going to talk about Dirty Projectors' new album, Dirty Projectors. Tom, thoughts?
I love this album. I thought it was just great. I mean, I was talking to Neil earlier on about the lyrics, and that's not really something that I kind of picked up on, though I understand that seems to be where lots of the reviews have gone, because this is obviously a breakup album. But for me, I just liked the way it sounded. I mean, I think there's been a lot of albums in the past few years that seems to, quote unquote, indie albums, which have kind of taken their cues from hip hop dance music, and this is certainly one of them. So it reminded me of Lamb Chop's album from last year, the Anoni album from last year, lots of the old auto-tune, which I didn't used to like, thinking of Cher, but I actually quite like. I mean, sometimes it sounds a bit demonic. Sometimes on the album, I thought there was something. It kind of, I don't know. It does something that doesn't always sound natural. And I thought it was possibly overused on the album. But I thought it sounded great. I thought it was. I've always liked Dirty Projectors, but I think that they're. Their sound has become more, dare I say, mainstream as they've progressed, and this is certainly, I'd say, a mainstream-ish album.
But it's very creative in terms of the kind
When I say mainstream, I guess I mean something that sounds... You don't have to work hard on this album. There's a lot going on. I'm not saying that there's not anything going on, but you don't have to work hard to get something from it.
Yeah. Neil?
Yeah, so I have an interesting experience with this record because I listened to it a couple of weeks ago, and or maybe even earlier than that, when we were first going to do this podcast.
Yeah. Giving away
sorry.
The magic.
No. Oh, yes. Sir. No, giving people worry. A peek behind the curtain. Yeah.
Yeah.
And I had a lot of... I was very conflicted about it, possibly erring on the side of not really liking it. But at the weekend, I listened to a podcast... which I would thoroughly recommend to anyone who's interested in music, called Song Exploder, in which there's a guy who interviews people and gets them to talk about one specific song that they've recorded. So he did a very good episode recently with Solange talking about her song Cranes in the Sky, which, as someone who isn't kind of hugely into lots of contemporary pop, was incredibly revelatory to me. And he got the Dirty Projectors chap, whose name I've forgotten,
Dave Longstreth.
Dave Longstreth, to talk specifically about the track on this album, Up in Hudson. And it was that was really fascinating. I mean, he was focusing on one track, but by proxy, that sort of reached out into the rest of the album as a whole, to hear not just. As someone who's a musician, getting a kind of VH1 behind the music on, and then I put this beat through this particular pedal and it did this, and you know, that's a bit geeky but quite interesting. But also to hear about his kind of overall concept, where he was drawing his influences from. Actually, I know with some records, or with most records, you should be able to listen to them in isolation and just sit down, put them on and be like, do I like this or don't I? But actually getting that context of where he drew the influence from, how he worked on the sound, just hearing things like the fact that he was in a recording studio and through the wall in the next room was Tondo Braxton, who was in Battles. So he actually said to him, well, look, I've got this little beat that I've made. And he's like, okay, let's put it through all these kind of like effects. So that's what ends up on the album. You actually see it in a whole new light. I mean, I always thought Up in Hudson was kind of the standout track on the record,
because it's
got a really interesting rhythm, which he says has been drawn from kind of 90s kind of hip-hop, oh, sorry, not early noughties hip-hop. And then he's kind of building on that with guitar, and the brass comes in as well. And also, crucially, I think that song has a bit less of the old autotune vocal, which is my personal preference. Any less autotune vocal is my personal preference. But it made me look at the whole record in quite a different light. I'd say that I think it's a much more meditative album than Beat It Orca, the previous one. I suppose almost inevitably, because it's just him on his own, with the rest of the band kind of gone their separate ways. The one point on that particular podcast where I felt he was ever so slightly disingenuous was he was talking about the lyrics that he mentioned, Tom, a lot of the reviews focusing on, I guess because the kind of the news story, if there is one, is that it's a breakup album, the girl he was in a band with has left the band now he's on his own. And he was trying to say that, I think, to distance himself from that kind of story, to say that, oh, well, you know, I'm writing about my own kind of like personal context, but it could be a metaphor for like anyone who's ever had a breakup, and to say like, well, if the lyrics are all about I wrote this specific Dirty Projectors song and then you joined the band and then we went on tour, does sound a little bit disingenuous to me, to see that, oh, but I was always thinking of it as some sort of metaphor.
It's a bit too grandiose.
That's my opinion. But
particularly because, you know, a breakup album is a well-trodden path.
Absolutely.
Like, you know, most recording
artists. Well, we were talking before this about kind of owning that soul-bearing aspect, and there's no shame in doing that, you know.
Brian Adams has done about three or four of them.
Sure, yeah.
At one point he says, it's interesting this, because at one point he says, one of the lyrics says, oh, I'm into truth and you were into fame. Which that seems to be quite a cutting sort of thing to say to someone. But then
particularly someone who joined Dirty Projectors. You know, it's like,
truth is quite an overarching thing to be after. I mean, I think that personally, I'm really interesting to note that when we first were due to record this podcast before some technical problems a month ago, I wasn't particularly enamoured with the album. I'm not really a fan of the band particularly. I have subsequently listened to it quite a lot for one reason or another, mixed in with other tracks that I've bought on other albums recently and in its own right. And I now really like it. I think it's incredibly inventive, musically. Yeah. I think that one of the reviews, I think it might be the quietest one, was making the point that, you know, lots of indie bands and indie people have flirted with using techniques from R&B and mainstream music in their oeuvre, but nobody has quite gone the whole hog as much as Dave Longstreth has on this album. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's every single sort of, you know, minute of the album seems to be sort of incredibly well crafted. There's some good songs as well. I really like, as you said, Up in Hudson, superb, very, very varied, several movements on that one. And I do like the single as well, Call Your Heart. I think that's good with great female vocals coming in on that one.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
I think it's a shame that they did break up, because the female vocals, I think, are often important with the Dirty Projectors.
Yeah.
I saw them play at a very small place in Coventry years ago, and it was just a small room. I think they were actually supporting another, and just the wall of sound that they produced was just absolutely incredible. I was just completely blown away. They're a band that actually not always needed, particularly big production values. They can create that sound.
Yeah.
So I guess maybe, but this is a very, very produced album. So.
Mm. Yeah, I think it's interesting we're talking about the noughties as a whole. I mean, they were one of those bands where I sort of said about the big band kind of thing. I mean, like Arcade Fire and them, there seemed to be a period where there were just like all bands had about seven members on stage, you know, like it was certainly a kind of shift from the kind of, you know,
polyphonic spree. Well,
exactly. We're taking it to an extreme, but you know what I mean. Yeah, yeah.
But it's also a decade of very musical bands. Mm-hmm. I mean, people went to, you know, music school, or at least dropped out of music school. St. Vincent's another example of someone who kind of probably achieved more fame in the last few years, but was in the polyphonic spree, you know, and went on to kind
played
of
played with Sufjan Stevens as well in his band.
But these people who have some sort of training can probably read music as well as play it.
I wonder whether sort of the female partner's departure from the band might have allowed him to just finally go the whole hog down this kind of R&B route, or whatever one imagines there might have been a lot of musical debate previously. I'm only speculating.
I think maybe, but I think it's an album that also shows that maybe some of these divisions between kind of like R&B indie music are kind of breaking down, particularly when you look at what's, you know, Pitchfork's covering now as an example, and other music websites as well. People are listening to a wider range of music, possibly because of what's happening in the past decade, and that's a good thing for music.
Yes,
people are going to be interesting and creative and do things that sound great.
I think, well, an interesting sort of view on the album. Thanks very much to everyone for listening. Quick repetition of just our main coordinate, which is that most people have been contacting us at soundingboard69. And we're going to be back. I think Tom's going to be coming back for the next episode, which is we're going to be looking back to the heady days of Britpop. So stepping back a decade. And then I think later in the year, we're going to have an Elvis one. So looking forward to the 18th century Madrigals one in 3 years' time. But thanks again to everyone for listening. Shouldn't be too long before the Britpop episode is in the can, and I hope you've enjoyed our noughties debate, and I hope you can sort of maybe carry on that debate a little bit on Twitter. Thank you very much.